Today on Wings.
Nobody came down off of a mountain with stone tablets that said the only way to make money off the internet is to spy on people.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
If you're going to create a censorship magic wand, you also have to look at who you're handing it to. And I think that this is another reason why we want a multiplicity of places where people can build safe communities for themselves rather than creating a big censorship stick and handing it to anybody, but certainly not the current federal government.
This is Suki Wessling of The Babblery. Cindy Cohen, the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has led the fight for online privacy for nearly 30 years. Cohen joined the nonprofit in 1993 when she was asked to lead a lawsuit against the United States Department of Justice in a groundbreaking case regarding cryptography. And if you want to hear her talk technicalities, she's fully able to do so. But I reached out to Cindy to ask if I could engage her in a much more accessible conversation about women's online privacy. She readily agreed to join me and says that there are deep systemic problems with the way we interact with the internet.
We didn't get into the problems with the internet with just one thing, so there isn't just one quick fix, but there are a few things we could do that would make things much better. And the first is comprehensive privacy protection.
In this episode, you'll hear one thing right away. Cindy Cohen is, as you'd expect from EFF, a fierce defender of online privacy and free speech. In this conversation, we explore some of the common arguments in favor of restricting online privacy and how guaranteeing privacy and freedom of speech for all bumps up against personal freedoms and safety. I started by asking Cindy to define what online privacy is.
So I think of privacy as maybe a little different than some people do. Some people think of privacy like the Harry Potter invisibility cloak that you throw over your head, you know, when you're about to do something you don't want somebody else to find out about it. Well, you know, privacy does that. I'm not saying it doesn't. But the reason I think privacy is important and far more important than that is because privacy is a way that people with less power can have a zone of protection from people who have more power. And I think about this from the very smallest to the very biggest level. On the very smallest level, my colleague, Eva Galperin, works with domestic violence victims, you know, a lot of women. And what do they find out? They find out that their abusers have put malware on their devices so that they can track them all the time, so that they don't have any privacy against their abusers. And they need privacy in order to plot their escape, in order to literally protect their lives from someone who's abusing them. That's how privacy works literally in people's houses. And then you can scale, you know, halfway, which privacy is how we get protection from the corporations who increasingly want to use all the information they know about us to say, decide how much we're going to pay for things and maximize how much we might want to pay, or decide what options we get when we're searching for a job, and those kinds of things that are more on the commercial side. But just as important, they have more power because they know more about us, and they use that power, they can leverage that power against us. And then out a little bigger, and you think about your role as a citizen, you know, we have the private vote in America. We have a secret ballot so that powerful people can't force you to vote for the person they want you to vote for. So it's your decision, not theirs. And those powerful people could be anywhere from your husband to your employer to the government in power. But that's why we have a private ballot in the United States. But it's also the way that people organize to make change. Every public fight for social justice in the United States has needed to have a private space for it to grow. And in my lifetime, we've watched gay rights, for instance, go from something that really people had to talk about in private because it was not popular and people could, you know, literally be attacked for standing up for these things, to the place where, you know, hopefully we can keep it, but the United States Supreme Court has recognized gay marriage and gay people have rights that are much closer to what they deserve than they had when this started out. But every public fight for people's rights has had to have a private dimension, especially in the early days. And I think people are seeing that now in the current administration, maybe a little more than they did in the past. People are recognizing that you need to use a privacy protective tool in order to organize and plan things, because otherwise it will get intercepted by people with more power who want to make sure that we all stay weak and powerless and unable to make changes to our government.
I asked Cindy about the current Republican-led state intrusion into medical records, specifically in the areas of pregnancy and transgender health, but with hints that they could cast the net more widely. These intrusions of women's privacy happened after the case that enshrined abortion rights, Roe v. Wade, was overturned. Some argue that the case was weak because it rested on privacy, which is not explicitly guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. Cindy disagrees.
I think that when the Fourth Amendment says you deserve to be secure in your papers, your home, and your effects, that's what it means. But we don't have the Supreme Court interpreting it that way as much as we should right now. And that's some of the work that EFF and others are doing in the courts, but that really we do need people to recognize that, you know, the word privacy doesn't have to be in the Constitution. Privacy protective ideas are woven throughout our Constitution, and they can exist in statutes even if they're not in the Constitution. I think it's a little naive of folks to think that one strategy would have won where the other strategy lost so badly. I think the answer to that is that we need to shore up privacy even more, not to abandon privacy as a thing we care about, because we don't have tools right now written down in the way that we might want to.
Cindy points out that the internet as we know it today was not designed with our rights in mind, and that's the source of many of the problems that we face, especially when it comes to commercial entities gathering our data.
I love technology. I love the benefits that technology can give to us. But the fact that we can click a box that says, oh, I hereby waive not only my privacy rights, but I want to be able to do blah, 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 blah. Like it's all mushed together in one click box, right? Like that's not okay. We need to have all the tools and we need to have the legal and policy structures that stand with us for those tools as well. And some of that information sharing should be a lot harder or a lot clearer to people about what they're doing, a lot harder to have just one click box mean, you know, 20 million different things at once, some of which are important and some of which are unimportant. You know, I just think that there's a way we can structure the world so that we can have the benefits of technology without so much of the bad sides. I mean, nobody came down off of a mountain with stone tablets that said the only way to make money off the internet is to spy on people, right? And yet, that seems to be the predominant business model. Well, that may take some law that says, you know, you can't have surveillance as a business model anymore. I think the goal ought to be to protect users and give them new technologies. I think that's doable in maybe 90% of the problems that we're all facing right now. And then there's the hard 10%.
That hard 10% often falls on the most vulnerable: minorities, queer folks, historically oppressed people, and, of course, women. One place where women differ from men is in healthcare, where we have to make decisions that collide with political ideology. Cindy sees women's privacy and freedom of speech as core values that we need to protect.
People who are seeking reproductive assistance need access to information, and we're seeing increasing censorship of that information by the sources that people normally go to, whether that's social media or even private websites. EFF just did a big report about censorship of reproductive information, and we found that even though the terms of a lot of these companies would, on their surface, mean that this information is available, and of course it's First Amendment protected, people were having access problems. People were having their websites taken down. People were having their Facebook groups taken down. And so even in the context of what's legal, there's a gap between what these companies say they're doing and what they're actually doing as a result, I think, largely of pressure.
In the U.S., Republican-led states are leading the way not only in trying to restrict access to information, but also in using women's online activity to track them and charge them with crimes related to reproductive health.
People are being prosecuted and tracked down based upon their online footprint or even their offline footprint. things like license plate readers and other offline surveillance are disproportionately aimed at people who are seeking reproductive care, which is a lot of women. So this is a specific area where I think women just seeking healthcare information or healthcare are finding that the lack of privacy and the censorship issues are getting in the way.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation focuses on a few different ways to protect women's online privacy. One is through legal action, but they also focus on education and creating easy-to-use tools.
A lot of online harassment and targeting is aimed at women. EFF has worked with groups around the world to try to put together security trainings for people, and whether that harassment is due from somebody in their own home or somebody outside. So the surveillance self-defense materials are a good place for people to start to kind of set things up to help protect themselves, to be able to get access to the information they need to communicate without having this risk of attack.
Every woman who's online has noticed that the sorts of abuse that people get in response to posting online may be equally vicious, but women get a particularly targeted kind of abuse, often threatening specific physical and sexual violence against her body or revealing information about her that makes her vulnerable. I asked Cindy to weigh in on how this abuse, which is free speech being exercised by men, curtails the free speech of women, who are justifiably more concerned about opening themselves up to threats of intimate violence when they post.
You know, we took an offline problem where women's protection and women's protection from abuse was not handled seriously by law enforcement and people in power. And we moved it over into the online world, and we're experiencing the same kind of situation in which people whose job it is to help protect us and keep us safe from abuse are rotten at it in the offline world, and they're rotten at it in the online world. And I just think it's really important. Like, women have had to publish under pseudonyms for years, right? Because of things like that. So I think that one of the problems is there's just not very much recourse offline or online to women being harassed. And so your ability to come after an abuser and get them to stop is, the tools are not great, right? And they need to be better. Like, you need to be able to get a restraining order against someone for online behavior and have it stick. And again, the problem of restraining orders not working very well is not an online problem. It's a problem in general of the way our society is slanted in ways that protect this kind of abuse. And so I tend to look at that, like, how can we make those tools better so that they're actually available, so that women who are facing this kind of things just don't get shrugged at by the law enforcement if these are actual threats, or on these online communities. I think the other thing that we believe strongly in is having a multitude of places where you can speak and participate. So if one isn't serving you, you can go somewhere else without losing your whole community. This is part of the reason why EFF is very supportive of some of the communities like Mastodon or Blue Sky or other kinds of communities that are not corporate controlled and don't have a surveillance business model. It's to let people be able to build communities that serve them rather than being, you know, stuck in these huge communities where there's a lot of abusers. You know, we've seen an exodus of people, of women, especially off of X, because there's so much abuse there. And luckily, there's some other places that they can go where it's less. It's still not great, but it's better. And I just think that the world in which there are two or three commercial, privacy-invasive products that try to do content moderation for the whole world, it's never going to work very well. Content moderation at scale is not going to work very well. So what do we need to do? We don't need to make the dictators nicer dictators. We need to get rid of dictators and have multiple options for people. I just think that expecting Mark Zuckerberg to get magically better at protecting women online, even if he wanted to, and I don't know, is going to be hard because of just the sheer scale and the difficulty of doing content moderation at scale and doing it in a way that doesn't throw the babies out with the bathwater. The other problem with this is the way that some of these companies are starting to be pushed towards limiting what people can say online isn't in the ways that maybe, you know, you and I would write if we got asked to write it. It's in the hands of the people in power. And right now, what does that mean? That means marginalized people are getting over-censored, even while the people who are the actual people that I think you and I might agree need more censorship or not. So you have to be careful if you're going to create a censorship magic wand. You also have to look at who you're handing it to. And I think that this is another reason why we want a multiplicity of places where people can build safe communities for themselves rather than creating a big censorship stick and handing it to anybody, but certainly not the current federal government.
This is Suki Wessling of the Babelry, and you're listening to Wings. We're speaking with Cindy Cohen, Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, about women's online privacy. Cindy and EFF stand against forcing social media to use moderation tools, and that might seem to be the place where they diverge from a common feminist approach. I asked Cindy to address the question that you hear women asking a lot. Wouldn't it just be easier if we required people to use their real names in online social spaces?
Look, they have done scientific research about anonymity, and we have a gigantic example in front of us, which is Facebook, right? Which requires real names. People aren't nicer to each other. This idea that anonymous speech allows people to be meaner to each other or to harass people more isn't actually borne out by the research. And I don't think it's actually borne out and people step back and look at it. People aren't nicer to each other on Facebook than they are on other platforms. So I think even our lived experience, if you step back and think about it, is not consistent with this idea that anonymity is the problem. Right now, we have people who harass with impunity. You can find them. It's not actually all that hard to find most of them. I mean, the number of people who can legitimately handle being untraceable online if they're engaging in a campaign and harassment, it's very small. It's that they're not being caught. It's that nobody's trying to catch them. It's that the cops say, oh, there's a VPN, there's nothing I can do. Of course there is. When they're trying to go after drug dealers, they can go past a VPN, right? Like, so I just think it's a problem of will and enforcement and not a problem of the technology. It's because historically, women's concerns about harassment haven't been taken seriously by the people who are supposed to protect us. And I think until we address that problem, all the getting rid of anonymity in the world is going to end up hurting those marginalized people. Look, EFF does human rights work all around the world. The ability to sneak information out of a repressive government and using anonymity, VPNs, tools like Tor, it saves lives. We wouldn't know the things we know about the Taiwanese fight for freedom. We work with a lot of Chinese democracy people. Now we've got people in Ukraine. We've got people in Gaza. We've got people, I mean, all over the world, Sudan, people all over the world who need to get information out of very scary places where there is official censorship. They need these tools and they rely on these tools. And if we decide that because cops aren't willing to investigate harassment, we're going to get rid of these tools, I think we're cutting off the people we're hurting. You know, it's not the right move to remove anonymity from everybody because some people misuse it. We have other tools to deal with abusers, but lots of people would like you to think that there's a technological fix for this. And if we just remove anonymity online, it'll all be well. I'm here to tell you, I don't think that's going to work. And you're going to hurt a lot of people along the way. And some of those are the same people you think you're helping.
It may sound sexist to say this, but it's literally not. One of the places where women's privacy is most violated is in online shopping. We are more likely to shop for our entire household rather than just ourselves. I asked Cindy to talk about the ways we're being tracked and the results of that tracking.
You know, there's a lot of tracking of us. There's also a lot of analysis of other people like us and people who we communicate with. Sometimes, you know, I often get the, oh, my phone must be listening to me because I was talking to my friend about, you know, this shirt. And the next thing you knew, I got an ad for the shirt. And, you know, I always kind of have a good news, bad news answer to that. The good news is they're probably not listening to you on your phone. And the bad news is they don't have to. because you're not that unique. Other people's preferences, people are micro created into these little categories. And so you end up getting the ad for the thing you were talking about, not because you're the only person in the world who talks about it, but because you're not the only person in the world who talks about it, and people tend to be segmented. So again, the good news, bad news is the good news is they're not tracking you individually at that level very much. The bad news is they don't have to, because they've got you segmented into, you know, mom with two dogs and, you know, a bad chewy habit, which would probably be me. And so the result for you is the same, which is you are tracked, and that tracking is organized and analyzed in ways that are increasingly marshaled against you. And we're beginning to see, I think people are beginning to see a lot more clearly the against you part of that, where we're starting to see what we call price discrimination, where the amount that you pay for something is based upon the fact that the companies who are charging you have all this other information about you and your ability to pay and your desperation for the thing that leads to you being charged a higher price than you might otherwise be charged. We just saw a report out of the New York Times about this, about home insurance, where people's credit rating was being used to decide, as part of deciding how much they paid for home insurance. And what they decided is if you've got poor credit, they can charge you more for home insurance and you will pay it. They know that you will pay more for home insurance if you've got a weaker credit score. I suspect in other situations it might be flipped, where if they know you've got more money, they're going to charge you more for certain things. But, you know, I think that strikes a lot of people as really unfair. And it's a result of this surveillance business model kind of coming to its natural conclusion now that they've got all this information, they're tracking us all the time, and they've got the analytical ability to set prices, you know, dynamically, and they don't have to set one price for everyone. They're going to start trying to maximize how much they can pull out of your wallet for each transaction. And we're starting to see that more. Of course, we see it on the other side as well, which is the kinds of things you get ads for are based upon who they think you are. And there's a famous, somewhat dated now, Facebook story about how women who were doing job searches on Facebook would not see ads for CEOs or higher paid jobs. They'd see ads for housekeepers and secretaries and things that are traditionally female jobs. And I don't think it's because Facebook was evil. It's because when you feed in data about the jobs that people have traditionally had, it's going to spit out the same jobs. That's another area where the fact that they're tracking who we are results in, you know, really, I think, horrifically discriminatory experiences online that can really affect us, that really impact people's lives in a real way.
And on top of all that, here comes AI. Cindy mentioned earlier that harassment on the internet is hard to deal with, not because it's different from real-world behavior, but because our real-world tools to deal with harassment are so poor. I pointed out to Cindy that because large language model artificial intelligence is based on the sum of human content on the internet, and that content is often sexist, not to mention racist and just plain factually incorrect, we have a bigger problem looming.
There's a whole field of AI research called alignment and other kinds of things that are trying to combat that, but they're kind of trying to put a Band-Aid on something and adjust it. And it's hard to marshal the resources to fix them. And public input into these things could be a helpful way to get started. I think a comprehensive privacy law that just says you don't get to spy on people as your business model would be another way to go about it, maybe a little quicker.
My final question for Cindy was about age verification requirements, which are being promoted as keeping kids from harm on social media and online pornography. Cindy says that age verification can work for pornography websites, but when the push is for a broader and vaguer sense of online safety for kids, she and EFF hear warning bells.
What they're trying to do is to say age appropriate for anything that might be harmful to kids, and that's a much broader term, and it includes things where I don't think everybody agrees. If you go to a red state and you talk to conservative people, they don't think having access to LGBTQ content or trans content, they think that harms kids. So I don't think anything, you know, most of the pornography sites are charging and they need identification. I think that the thing that we're fighting now with a lot of the age gating is this idea that some stuff is harmful to kids, and that's a much broader category, and it's why EFF is so concerned and think it's a really bad idea. Because if we don't have a shared agreement about what's harmful to kids, then you're just handing a censorship tool to people. And so you can get really tricky. Like, we've spent years trying to help women who have breastfeeding forums continue to have their forums when they get flagged for nudity because somebody's taking a picture and saying, like, she's not latching. How does this work? Or I've got this, you know, rash or something. What does this look like? And they get flagged as pornography. So again, I think that we have to be really careful when we think about how we want to respond to these problems. And it's quite often women who end up getting sideswiped worse by these kinds of things, because a lot of women's health depends on us being able to be honest about our bodies, and it gets labeled pornography by a set of people who, if they're in charge, that's what happens. And I've spent probably the most consistent amount of time over the 25 years I've been at EFF trying to make sure that women can talk about breastfeeding online, as I've done almost anything else, because of society's uncomfortableness with women's bodies.
Cindy Cohen wrote a book, a legal memoir called Privacy's Defender, about her work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Although the book chronicles the losses alongside the wins, it offers an essentially optimistic and positive view of this online world we've found ourselves in.
There are real problems, and I, you know, obviously I've spent my life trying to fight for a better online world, and we have not finished with what we're doing. But sometimes I think it's easy to miss what we've gained. I'm in New York City, and I think you're in Santa Cruz, and we are having a real-time conversation that I'm not worried about how much this is going to cost me, right? It's a whole new way for people to stay connected that didn't exist in the same way before we had this. I'm watching all of the organizing that's happening right now against the excesses of this administration. It's all organized, you know, online, even if there's offline in-person things, which are really important. It's a mix. It's not one or the other, right? And they feed each other, and people are using the tools. I wish that more people were able to use more private tools, but that's happening. This organizing is being made possible because of the digital network. So I still am excited about the prospect of that. We have to fight. You know, John Perry Barlow once told me, no one gives you your rights, you have to take them.
Women know that we have to take our rights, and we've worked hard to do it. But the job is never done, and the online world offers new and confusing challenges. Do we protect our privacy and the privacy of those we disagree with? Thanks to Cindy Cohen of the Electronic Frontier Foundation for speaking with me and explaining the challenges so clearly. You can find more information and some excellent tools for safeguarding yourself and those you love at EFF.org. For Wings, this is Suki Wessling of the Babblery. Learn more about my show at babblery.com. The song Silence is courtesy of Unwoman at unwoman.com. Thanks for listening.
Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cohen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.